21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Oh, my goodness, it's the Traveling Wilburys. Now, I mean, Jesus, whiz. Hey, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is the alleged Dr. Bob Hieronymus hanging out in this part of the universe. And, of course, our executive producer and research assistant and my boss who pushes me around all over the place is Laura Kortner. And our engineer is Kristen Hagerick. There they go. Well, friends, where would America be without New York City? Huh? Where would the planet Earth be without New York City? Well, I have personal opinions about this. And my own personal perspective on New York City has been, well, it's been an important part of my life. In the early 60s, I found myself singing for the first audiences in the clubs of the East Village. And it's where I first spent time with brother Jimi Hendrix at Steve Paul's The Scene. And you know what we were talking about? Yeah, you know what we were talking about. We're talking about pyramids and eyes in a triangle. Have you ever seen him draw pyramids and eyes in a triangle? He did. Then, of course, lecturing at the School of Visual Arts. Always a good time. And especially when I'm talking about the Yellow Submarine. And hanging out with my dear friend, who's passed on some years ago, and legend Heinz Edelman, who is the artistic director of the Beatles' animated Yellow Submarine film. Peter Max had nothing to do with it. And if you see Peter Max tomorrow, you tell him, you ain't had nothing to do with it. He'll agree with you eventually, because he's read my book. He's in the book. And, of course, there was always the wonderful times sleeping in Washington Square. I don't know if you can do that anymore. Well, today, I have two daughters who lived in New York City. And today, they still visit the city from Brooklyn. And when we get the time, we visit one of my favorite places, the National Arts Club, of which we are members. Now, this hour, we're going to spend some time with Mitch Broder, whose book, Discovering Vintage New York, I don't think he pronounces it that way, but I do. A Guide to the City's Timeless Shops, Bars, Delis, and More. Which, well, it's already gone through its first printing. But Amazon and stores still should have some. Discovering Vintage New York takes you to a city of egg creams and knishes. Oh, boy, those knishes. We used to live on those things. Of record stores and hat shops. Oh, JJ hats. That's where I get my hats. Good old JJ hats, of bohemian basements and candlelit clubs. Never been to places like that, of course. Mitch Broder is a prize-winning journalist who spent 20 years writing about Manhattan for Gannett Newspapers, the nation's largest newspaper chain. He's also written for the New York Times, the Daily News, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, and even other papers. Welcome back to, no, actually, welcome to 21st Century Radio, Mitch. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Bob.
Is your pitching arm all right tonight?
Yeah, you make all this sound so good.
Well, it is good. I mean, this is a great book. I had a, it's sold out, the first edition already, and it's going into the second. I mean, I had such a good time going through this book. I hope you and I meet sometime, because
yeah,
I want to show you this book that I've read of yours. Every page has got notations all over the place in it.
Wow.
I mean, it's really something. Well, let's get to some of this stuff. Please tell us what this book is and what isn't it.
Well, what it is truly and surprisingly the first and only book that covers these classic spots that you're talking about. It covers over 75 restaurants, shops, bars, delicatessens, bakeries, night spots, all of which are still around and all of which have been around for about 50 to 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
What it is not is a collection of every place that's old requirement. There were entrance requirements. The entrance requirement for this book was to be a place that takes you back in time, a place that evokes another era, another way of life in the city, so that places that have just been around for a long time are not in here. They really have to have the feeling. They have to look the part.
Well, we're going to test that out when we come up to New York City. We are. Have a good. I am so happy to know whether you want to talk about it or not. We're still going to touch on J.J. hats later on. Okay.
Yes.
It's so wonderful to learn the history of places that you've been going to. Well, I've been going to at least through the mail and everything else, ordering hats. Because they have some, as you know, some of the best in the whole planet. But now, how did this book come into existence? Even though a book's never been written about this before, and I can't understand why, because I always liked the old New York. New York today is great, but still, the old New York to me is the most fascinating of all the places, especially before Robert Moses made everything great.
Yeah.
How did this book come about? How did you come to write it?
Well, as you said, I was covering the city for Gannett for many years, and I've always liked old places, and I would write about these places when I could while I was writing feature stories and columns for Gannett. And as I got better acquainted with these places, it occurred to me that I should put them all together in one place, that I should write a book about them. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like there should be a guide for people, because I know that people who visit the city love to go to these places, and they have appeal to everyone, young and old, and people from all over the world, and it just seemed like they should be collected. And the idea also was to try to keep them around. They go out of business, and then people mourn them. They say that they should have gone there, or they wish they'd gone more often. And so my idea was to get people to get going to these places before it's too late.
Yeah, that's you never can tell what else is going to disappear there. Jeez, oh whiz. Have you thought, how long did you work on this? A couple of years or what?
Well, in a sense, for years, because I was learning about these places, writing about them, but intensively it was about 2 years. I went to every single place and spent many hours at each one. I wanted this all to be firsthand reporting. And part of my goal was to get the story straight, because, you know, a lot of these places have mythology, and in some cases these places are being run by family members of the fourth or fifth generation, and even they believe the mythology that has been passed down, and they don't always check up on it. And as you know, a lot of things just get passed along and never checked. And I really wanted to see how well I could get these histories straight. Because another thing that I noticed was that sometimes places like this would go out of business and they would leave nothing behind. There would be no history. There'd be no photographs except what somebody might have in an attic or a basement. And it seemed to me that a place that survived in New York City for 50, 75, 100 years, that's a part of the city's history, and it should be documented in some way. It should be remembered in any case. And the idea that these places could just vanish and be totally forgotten was amazing to me. So I wanted to, in some cases, for some of these places, I actually wrote the first history of the place, the first documentation of the place, so that I feel like at least I'm contributing in some way.
Well, your book's a major contribution. Because of the kind of research that you did, it's really very intensive. And you do, there are some of the myths that I knew about New York City. You certainly helped them get rid of them. And that must have taken you an awful lot of time. But you probably had just a terrible time visiting all those places.
It was awful.
It was difficult. I know. It must have been just plain terrible going to Club 21.
I think the people who might have suffered were the owners, who I would keep, you know, at the table for 2 or 3 hours at a time. But you know, the truth is, I think they liked it, because these people are proud of these places. They're proud, and they most of them just jumped at the opportunity to share their histories and to brag a little bit about the place.
Well, how about telling us a story of how you discovered some of these favorite vintage spots.
Okay. Well, what I did from the start is I walked the city. I decided that in order to find all the places in the ways I just described them to you, what was to check them all out because age wasn't going to be enough. And I essentially auditioned every old joint in Manhattan to get these places. And one of my favorite discoveries was came on a day when I was walking down 2nd Avenue, got to 31st Street, and saw a curious building. It caught my eye because I could see it was a gathering place of some sort, but there were no people inside, and there was no sign outside. It actually was about to storm, so I needed to take shelter. So I walked around the corner onto 31st Street. The door was open. I walked in. It was quiet. It was dark. And in the darkness, a woman appeared. This really happened. The woman said to me, "Hello." And I said, "Hello. What is this?" And she said, "It's a restaurant." And I said, "Oh, how long has it been here?" She said, "About 80 years.
Whoa.
I said, "Oh, well, I'm writing about places that have been around for 80 years. I can see you're not open right now, but do you have a menu I could look at?" She said, "No, we don't have a menu. We just make one meal every night."
Oh, that's a great story.
Well, I said, "Oh, so you make a different meal every night and the customers are surprised?" She said, "No, we make the same meal every night and no one's ever surprised." Mm-hmm. So, that was all I needed. And fortunately, they let me in, and I spent 3 hours with the woman, who is Christine Markey, and her husband, Mario Markey, and they told me about their restaurant, which is called Markey's Restaurant, M-A-R-C-H-I. This place opened in 1929. It was actually the apartment of Mario's parents, Lorenzo and Francesca Markey. Lorenzo was a good chef, and Francesca was really good at cooking his recipes, and in 1929, in an attempt to make ends meet, they started taking in neighbors and friends for dinner at 50 cents a pop. Mm. And it worked. And before long, their apartment was a restaurant.
Well, I just love that story. I mean, this is the kind of book, you know, it's too bad. When did this come out? Did this come out any time in the summer?
This book?
Yeah.
June was the publication.
Oh, I can see everybody sitting on the beach reading this.
Yeah.
No, really. I mean, you know, visiting the New York City beaches, reading about it. No, really, some of these stories are just the kind of things that made me love New York even more, and especially when it comes to food. Being an artist myself, all artists go through the process. I know you probably never went through the process of starving to death and everything. Right? You never did, right?
Come close.
But you came close, huh? But you know, it's one of those things I think most artists, all kinds, regardless of their, especially poets, God, you get used to one meal a day. And boy, it was great being in New York. When I was up there, you can get a knish for 10 cents, 15 cents sometimes.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Potato knishes and meat knishes, but we'll talk about that, hopefully, that knish store another time, because now I understand you can get all kinds of knishes that would have been against the law back in the old days.
Yes.
And thanks to some lady that you're going to have to tell us about later. Yes. Now, Katz's Delicatessen.
Katz's.
Yeah.
Well, Katz's is one of my favorites because you may share this, I don't know, but I have a particular love of the look and feel of mid-20th century New York City, and I have a feeling you like that, too.
I do. Yes, I do. I'm biased.
And Katz's just captures that. You walk in, and it's a great New York gathering place. It's all the things I usually hate about a restaurant. It's loud, it's confusing, it's chaotic, but I love it because it just feels like New York. The place just has that feel. And to me, it's reminiscent of the old Automats, which were so loved by New Yorkers and are still fondly remembered by those of us who can still remember them. They were gathering places for everyone from starving artists to movie stars because everyone could afford something there and you knew you were going to get a good meal. And that's what Katz's is like. It's just it's a place where you can feel like you're part of something, and that's getting so hard to find in New York. Everywhere, a place where you just feel like you're part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
also a great place for pastrami, corned beef, and hot dogs.
Would you please tell us a little about pastrami? Because I have some misunderstandings about that. Because the only pastrami I used to get was so fatty that...
Well, it is supposed to be fatty. That's the joy of it.
And it's still
I actually prefer corned beef, but pastrami does seem to be it's sort of a New York icon, pastrami, along with hot dogs and dishes. But it's a cured meat, and I don't like to know too much more than that. I like to stop at it tastes good and not go far beyond that.
Oh, gosh, Rudy, the time's going too fast, and we got to take a break. Okay, friends, Mitch Broder, Discovering Vintage New York, a guide to the city's timeless shops, bars, delis, and more. Globe Pequo? Is that how I pronounce that? I thought it was GPP, but, you know, what do I know? I'm just an artist here. Order the book or find Mitch's blog at mbvintage.newyork.blogspot.com. Did I put too many dots in there? Yes, I did. mbvvintagenewyork.blogspot.com. And you can find that on 21st Century Radio. Mitch is hanging out over there with, he's having a Nathan's hot dog right now.
Hello, everybody. This is Graham Nash. Right now, you're listening to 21st Century Radio with my friend, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. We need people that are putting the truth in front of our faces. We need leaders. We need great voices on the radio. Dr. Bob is one of them.
Hey, and we need Graham Nash, and he's coming back. That's right. We're dragging him out. He's dragging out again in January. Is that right, in January? Oh, we're going to have a good time. Wait till you hear his book. Yes, it's a really wild book. Right now, we're having a wild time with Mitch Broder, Discovering Vintage New York, a guide to the city's timeless shops, bars, delis, and more. Globe Pequot. That's what I was told to say. Order the book or find it at Mitch's blog, mbvintagenewyork.blogspot.com. And you can find that at 21stcenturyradio.com. Mitch, you write so well.
Thank you.
It is fun. This book, that's one of the reasons why it's so much fun. Oh, but now we're going to go hang out at Arthur's Tavern. What are we going to find there?
Oh, boy, Arthur's Tavern. Well, Arthur's Tavern is another favorite. It's in the West Village, and there's a big concentration of vintage spots in the West Village. Arthur's is actually a dive bar, and it's like many dive bars in the city. It's dusty and kind of dark, and it's got the international symbol of the dive bar, the permanent Christmas lights strung up. What's different about Arthur's is the entertainment. For example, tomorrow night, you could go to Arthur's, and from 7 to 10, you could hear a couple sets of music played by a little Dixieland band called the Grove Street Stompers. Now, that, too, might sound unremarkable until you find out that the reason that the Grove Street Stompers are playing at Arthur's Tavern on Monday night is that the Grove Street Stompers have been playing at Arthur's Tavern every Monday night since their first gig in November of 1962.
Oh, my God. I was up there. That was when I was in the East Village. Yeah, 1962.
And even though they have had some personnel changes in the band, the guy who plays the piano, who is also the band leader, is also the founder. His name is Bill Dunham. He's 85. He's been playing at Arthur's every Monday night for 51 years,
God.
And he's still getting paid $35 a night.
Oh, he's making a fortune.
Yeah. <He's>,
permanent job here.
He can't give it up.
No, but I got to read this one paragraph. Yeah, you got to. Can you keep your mouth shut for just a second?
Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, listen. Listen to this, friends. Arthur is said to have opened in 1937. No one seems to have any recollection of Arthur. The rusted neon sign outside says Arthur's Steaks, Chops. But in 50 years, Bill says he's never seen a he's never seen a steak or a chop, though for a while he saw popcorn machine. That's what I mean. That's why I had such a good time reading your book.
Good.
You have a great sense of humor from that standpoint.
Well, thanks, and I was really hoping to bring out, you know, we're talking a little bit about history here, but what I really wanted to convey in this book is the fun. You go to these places for a good time.
Yeah.
They're fun. They're not. They're like little living museums, but they're not museums. You know, they're, mm-hmm. You don't go there with your hands at your sides. You go to have a good time.
Yeah, well, you're going to have a good time at the next place. A wonderful time reading about the Papaya King.
Oh, yes.
Tell us
it's
about
one of my favorites because, as you may have picked up, I kind of do like hot dogs. I have the taste of a five-year-old.
Hey, do you like Nathan hot dogs?
Yeah, Nathan's are good.
You know, I've traveled all over town one time before I had to start a mural, and I couldn't find a Nathan hot dog. And I just, obviously we had to go out and order some. But, I mean, I don't know why they taste so good. Maybe it's all the sodium in it. I don't know. Yeah, but there is a lot. But tell us a little bit about Papaya King, because, boy, did I learn a lot here.
Well, Papaya King has a great history. It starts with a guy named Gus Poulos, who lived in Greece, and he came to America, settled in New York, in a neighborhood called Germantown. Then he went on a vacation to Cuba, where he got fascinated with the fruit. So he came back to Germantown and opened up a stand selling juice made from that fruit, except he actually got the fruit from Florida and for some reason called the stand Hawaiian Tropical Drinks. He opens up the stand, and it's not doing well because people want something to eat with their juice. So because he's in Germantown and happens to have a German girlfriend, he adds Frankfurters to the menu, and he creates this New York City culinary marriage that has endured. It's had hundreds of imitators, and it was immortalized in an episode of Seinfeld in which Kramer stands in front of a movie theater at dusk, looks across the street, and cries out, "I don't want a movie hot dog. I want a Papaya King hot dog."
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there have been imitators galore with all sorts of papaya names, but this is the original, and it's still there on 86th Street.
Is that's the place where Babe Ruth once ate 12 hot dogs between...
Yes, the feature that I've always loved about this place is they have little signs up all over the place. A lot of them extol the health benefits, which I just love, you know, a hot dog place that tells you to come in because you're going to get healthy.
Yeah, that's right.
I think they're concentrating on their healthful fruit drinks, but they make it sound like... one of the signs says they're quoting Dr. John Harvey Kellogg as saying papaya is the most powerful digestive known, you know, and then they have health benefits on the paper cups you get with the drinks, and they have a sense of humor about themselves, but it's just so New Yorkian, and they have one of my favorite slogans in the city, which is tastier than filet mignon.
Filet mignon, that's
right. Yeah.
But you know, Babe Ruth, he's my favorite baseball player in the whole wide world. And I can never wear my Babe Ruth hat at Orioles Stadium because I get beat up every time I do.
Yeah,
and that's unfortunate because he was, you know, he's a Baltimorean. He was just an interesting fella. 12 hot dogs between games. Well, he probably then went out to the game, hit 4 or 5 home runs, and then went out and partied with a couple of prostitutes afterwards. I mean, that's Uncle Babe, all right.
It could be a myth, but I like to believe that the Babe could have done that.
Oh, I believe it. I believe it. He's my, you know, I grew up in a place in Baltimore in which he played baseball right behind my house, and it was just, and he's just an extraordinary. There's a lot of things about his life people don't know, and they're really excellent in regards to children.
Yeah.
Now, then there's Marie's Crisis Cafe.
Crisis. Well, Marie's Crisis is another dive bar, and it happens to be right next door to Arthur's.
But it's
very different because you can walk into Marie's Crisis any day of the week from 5 in the afternoon till 3 o'clock in the morning, and you will see a bunch of people standing around a piano singing show tunes. I don't know how they perpetuate this crowd. I don't think it's the same people all 10 hours every day, but no matter when you walk in there, there are people singing show tunes. They have a staff of pianists who clearly know every show tune ever written, and in the course of a shift probably play every show tune ever written, and it's just this party. city that goes on and on and on. You can walk in. It's free. You can sit there and watch these people singing. Some of them are actual singers. There are people who appear on Broadway who go there to just to keep singing, and there are amateurs. You can join in. You can solo if you want. The only thing you have to pay for is a drink if you want it. And it's just a place you can go to cheer up any night of the week.
I'm trying to think of the person that plays those songs. I can't remember his name. I know it's on page 122 somewhere, but he says...
Jim Allen?
Pardon me?
You mean the pianist, Jim Allen?
Yes, Jim Allen. Thank you. He says, "My philosophy is to play 9 songs they know and 1 song they don't know."
Right.
That's pretty good philosophy, all right. Oh, my, what a place. God.
You're
going to have to take me to 4 or 5 of these places when we get together.
I'd love to.
Now, I might mispronounce this one, but it's all your fault if I do.
Yes.
Yonah Schimmel Knish Bakery. Oh,
that's
gosh.
Very good.
Yeah. I did okay?
That's excellent. Yeah.
I got a B- or a B or something like
no,
that?
No, that's an A.
Oh, wow. All right. Okay, tell us about this
Knish. Yonah Schimmel is where you go for a 103-year-old Knish, because it was founded in 1910. One of the original Knish places. There used to be more, of course, on the Lower East Side, where there were many, many Jewish immigrants came around the turn of the century. Yonah Schimmel Knishes, the place has been there since 1910, and you walk in, and you really still... feel like it must be the way it was in 1910. They still have the dumb waiter that brings the knishes up from the oven, and they have this counter in the front, a glass counter with a white frame, and the frame has been repainted so many times it looks like white icing.
I love that phrase. That was good.
It's just an amazing place, and the current owner is happy to talk about. You know, if you get curious about Yonah himself, she will talk to you about him. And she said one thing to me that I'll never forget. I was asking her about Yonah because in my research, I saw him described as various things. I saw him described as having been a rabbi, having been a Torah scribe, having been a Talmudic scholar. It isn't clear if he was one or all of these things. But she told me, the current owner, Ellen Anastatov, said, that's not really the point. The point is, he wanted to teach people spirituality, but there was no money in it.
Right to the point.
Yes.
Right to the point. I mean,
and so he sold knishes instead. And they're still making his original knishes by the original recipes. Through the years, they have, as you mentioned, added some that would never have been acceptable years ago.
Was it Alex that did that? No. Was it Ellen? Ellen who added?
Yes, she has been adding more and more flavors.
Yeah, tell us.
To keep up with the times.
Yeah, what kind of other flavors did she add? Because I thought these were...
I can't remember offhand, but I can look that up for you.
There were fruit ones. I mean, Oh, gosh, Rudy. Well, hey, listen, we're going to run out of time if we hang out with too much time at the old Yonah Schimmel.
I'm sorry,
Knish
I can't
Bakery.
Remember everything I wrote.
What? Why can't you? Come on, geez, oh whiz. Every author is supposed to remember every word they've
every
ever said.
Every word, I know. I'm ashamed of myself.
What a shameful performance. Well, we need to come back up, take a break yet? No, we don't have to. Good. Okay, now, there's Rolf's German Restaurant, which at this time of the year is a Christmas wonderland. Oh, geez, you got to tell our listeners about good old Rolf's.
Sure is. It is unbelievable. You walk in there and you're just in. Well, the owner, Bob Maizano, says that his goal was to create the feeling of being in or under a Christmas tree. So you're actually in the tree. The place is filled with tens of thousands of Christmas decorations, and they are mostly antique German ornaments. This is the real thing. Along with tens of thousands of lights, garlands, icicles. You walk in, you can't see the place. And I don't like to quote myself, but I did say in the book that it's no longer a restaurant with decorations. It is decorations with a restaurant.
Yeah.
And it's just, and it has become a worldwide destination for Christmas. He keeps them up for 3 solid months, November, December, and January. And it takes 6 weeks before November, every night after closing, to put them all up, and it just adds and adds every year. I think eventually there won't be room for any tables. It's just you can't believe it until you actually walk in there. People can tell you about it, but you walk in and
Well, I like your comment here. Last year, I caught a girl. She came prepared with a shopping bag climbing up to the ceiling. She brought scissors or wire cutters, and she started cutting down the decorations. She was getting ready to take them home.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty extraordinary. I mean, I would have it takes a lot of guts to do it. But in New York, you got a lot of guts.
I know some people think, I think some people may actually believe that that's okay. And
yes,
she
yes.
may have been one of them. And I think they tried to be polite by saying, please wait and don't do that.
How can you be polite about that? Jeez, it was. I mean, because those are pretty expensive stuff. You know,
yeah, the antiques, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
very
well,
valuable.
Now...
I think she was going after one of the good ones.
Now, here's a place also I would have loved to have gone. It's called the Music in World Instruments. Boy, mm-hmm. this sounds like the kind of place I'd like to fall asleep in. Tell us,
I
please.
I think you'd like this place.
I know I would. I know I would.
It's a place that in its younger days was visited by the likes of John Lennon and Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Who in the hell are they? You know,
I'm not sure, but I've heard of them.
Oh, I've heard of some.
I think they were important in music.
Oh, maybe.
Or comedy. I'm not sure.
Yeah, both. Both.
Both, right. And Music Inn actually began as a record store in 1958, but the owner was fascinated with instruments, and he traveled around and kept bringing in more and more instruments until the instruments pushed the records into the basement, and they pretty much took over the shop. And until recently, the current owner has actually made a little bit of walking space, but until recently, the place was just literally packed. Instruments hanging from the ceiling, instruments piled on the floor, stuffed into what used to be the record bins. You could barely get in. And Music Inn kind of shows the power of legend, because for a while, the original owner actually put up a chain and charged a dollar to get in. He really did this to try to discourage people who were just coming in to look around and ring the bells and shake the maracas. But it didn't last that long, and yet decades later, to this day, when I mention Music Inn to people who have heard of it, they say, oh, isn't that the place that charges admission to get in? It's something like that, just mm-hmm. never dies.
Yeah, well, they'd want to see where... You know, as you note in your book, Dylan lived a couple of doors down.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm sure he probably left all of his old music there in some other room, so you could probably steal it in the garbage can.
Yeah.
And then John Lennon, of course, he certainly hung out there all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. Now, gosh, we got to take a break. Yes, we do. And there's so many things to cover in here. We're not going to get up to them all. And this is a real problem for me, because I enjoyed such things at like McSorley's Old Ale House. That's where I want to go. I can see Mitch and I hanging out at good old McSorley's Old Ale House.
That sounds good.
Then after that, we'll go over to the 21 Club and have a great time. Then we'll go to the House of Oldies. But we probably won't have any time to talk about any of those. But we'll be back with Mitch Broder, Discovering Vintage New York, a guide to the city's timeless shops and bars and delis and more. Globe Picquot. Order the book or find it at Mitch's blog. And that's mbvintagenewyork.blogspot.com at 21stcenturyradio.com. And you'll see him hanging around over there at the bar.
Hello there, this is George Martin, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Well, there's Uncle George, and we haven't had him on the show for a while. I hope he's doing well, hope his family is doing well, and I hope he's enjoying his yellow submarine toys. We've been providing him with some corgi toys and swimming pool toys for his entire family and stuff like that. He even has a Woodstock bus. He really does. He plays with it. And so do I. I play with my Woodstock bus. Now, our guest, of course, is Mitch Broder, and Discovering Vintage New York, a guide to the city's timeless shops, bars, delis, and more. Globe Picquot, I'll tell you, you're going to love this book. Obviously, a lot of people love this book. I mean, it's sold out. It's in its second edition already. And it'd be the kind of thing that would be great for Christmas, especially because you will laugh your ears off. No, or other things you might laugh off besides your ears. And it's the kind of thing that you can share, especially if you've ever... There's a mystique about New York that I find extraordinary, especially old New York before a lot of big changes took place. Now, well... There are a lot of places we'd also like to visit, but I got to ask you some different kinds of... Oh, no, wait, no, no. The silversmith. What a story this is. The silversmith, the story of the tiniest vintage spot. And it is tiny. Please tell us about it, Mitch.
Silversmith is tiny because it's in an alley. It's actually built between two buildings. And that's why its street number is 184 and three quarters. That number up large so you can see it because you could miss the store. And the silversmith, it's a jewelry store, and it's one of the last places in the village where you can get the feeling of Greenwich Village the way many of us think of it, as a place where an artist could afford to live, could afford a place to work, and could make a living selling what he makes. And the proprietor of the silversmith is a woman named Ruth Kuzib. She came to New York from Cleveland to sing and dance.
Same old song and dance.
Yeah, she was a Cooper girl, and she actually made it to Broadway in a mid-50s musical called Fanny, but she apparently found her calling in this store. She joined it in 1960, so she has spent over half a century in a store that's barely big enough for four people standing up, and it has two cats in it, which takes up more of the space. The cat bed is in front of the counter, and these cats are not particularly fond of people, but fortunately, Ruth is. She's amazing. She's 85. She still bikes to work. She opens only in the evenings, and some nights after closing, in the wee hours of the morning, you can find her singing show tunes at Marie's Crisis.
Oh, my. All right, well, you know, listen to this, friends, she said, there are other disadvantages. I've been held up. I've been tied up. I've had a knife at my throat. I've had a gun in my face. And the store has been burglarized four times. The cats have been of no help. And, of course, you can't pet them, right? You can't pet them.
They're not real receptive to physical affection.
Yeah, they'll bite you. Okay, now, I've been playing around maybe too much here, and I apologize, Mitch. It's just that this book puts me in such a good sense of humor here. Why are these places important?
Well, as I said, I see them as treasures, and I find it amazing to have a city like New York that is peppered with places like this where you can walk into them and experience life in another time in the city's history. That in itself is amazing. But I know that today everything's about money. I see them as very valuable to the city, and I'm not sure how much recognition that gets, but as they keep disappearing, the look and the feel of New York changes, and makes me wonder how far the city wants to let that go.
Would you give us some examples of places that have just recently disappeared?
Yeah, well, fortunately there was only one, but I did write about one place and finish the story, and it didn't make it to the book because it closed before the book came out, and that place is called Prime Burger. This was a hamburger place on 51st Street across from St. Patrick's, and it was taken over in 1965, redone in 1965, and never changed since, so it was perfectly captured 1965. It had these conical space-age light fixtures, but the dominant feature was the seating. They had these seats that were like box seats with a swiveling fake walnut tray table that they would close over you like the bar in an amusement park ride. And once they put your food on this tray, you couldn't get up. If you had to go to the bathroom, you needed the waiter to come over and get you out. And people sat in these seats. It was funny. You'd see these guys in suits sitting in these little seats with these trays closed in around them, and it looked like some kind of bizarre club. And this place, they played old music. Just everything about it was perfectly preserved. And it's one of those cases where I think they were paying something like $10,000 a month rent. The building got sold, and the rent went up to
$60,000.
You can't sell enough hamburgers to keep a place going at $60,000 a month, and this happens all the time.
No, I'm sorry for laughing, but it's just...
No, it's absurd.
It is
amazing.
Absurd.
And
as you say...
That's the way rents are going in the city.
That's what, and repeatedly you say throughout the book that, you know, some of the places save themselves by end up buying the building before they get thrown out or can't afford it anymore.
A lot of these places, a good portion of the places in the book, have survived because families generations ago bought the building.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
The buildings were affordable, mm-hmm. either out of great wisdom or just out of practicality. And so now, like little bakeries that I write about in this book, they would never be around if they would not be able to survive. You have to have the finances of a huge chain for most things that survive in the city now. Any length, so a lot of the places in the books have survived only because of that. It's because one by one they would go when the rents go up, because increasingly landlords can get those rents.
Well, we're going to get to the J.J. Hat Center. I have done a lot of shows on history and National Geographic and Discovery Channel and all those channels, And whenever I wear a hat, if I wear my derby or I wear a top hat, I love to wear a top hat. You can't get a good top hat in the city of Baltimore. You really got to go to New York to get some of the best hats. Would you please tell us a little about J.J. Hats? I have sent so many people up there, but I've never been there, never seen the place.
Yeah, it's really, you know, there are other hat stores, but it's really the last of the full service men's hat stores where you can go in and, like you said, get any kind of hat, including a top hat. And the one of the amazing things about JJ is that it's in this store. You walk in and you feel like it's been there since the business came about in 1911, but they actually moved in there, I think it was 1995, because the previous owner, who was a lifelong hat man, spotted this place. It had actually been an IBM showroom where they sold things like tabulating machines, and he caught it in disrepair, and he just kind of visualized that it was actually meant to be a hat store. Somehow he looked at this place and said, this should have been a hat store. And he saved the business, moved it in there, and restored the place. It's beautiful. It's full of marble and terrazzo and fireplace. So it's a great setting for the feeling, the old-time feeling you would want in a hat store like that. And it does get people from all over the country, like you say, people who can't find the hats anywhere else go to JJ to find what they need. People plan it when they're planning a business trip to New York. They plan in a visit to JJ.
You note that there were 48 men's hat stores just in Manhattan, and they're the only true men's hat store left. Whoa! Boy, that's scary. Really, you know, because if they pass out, I don't know what's going to happen there. I don't know where in hell.
Tribute to these people that they've managed to keep the one alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you note, suppose you have to get your hat blocked and cleaned. They don't clean it for free, but they block it for free. Is that right?
It's almost as if they want to be friends to anyone who believes in hats.
Yeah. Well, now. Never thought we'd have time to get to this one. McSorley's Old Ale House.
McSorley's is certainly one of the better known places, and it is actually the oldest vintage spot in the book. Its opening date is believed to be 1854, and really one of the most authentic places. The time to visit, if you really want to see the authenticity, is during the day, because it is a scene at night. It is so packed with people that they need guys to keep people out because there's no more room. It can be very loud. It's a big party at night. But during the day, you can see all the antiquity. You can see the icebox. stove and all the things on the wall. And of course,
hey, you forgot to talk about the picture of the naked lady.
Well, I didn't know if that was proper on the radio, but
yeah. Oh, that's right. I forgot. Yes,
the obligatory, because it was.
Yeah, you better not talk about that.
Yeah, probably not. But that does bring up the point that it was a men's bar, and you know, the surprising thing to many people about McSorley's is that women were not allowed in until 1970, and that was only after the place was sued to let them in. And the other side of that story is that the owner of McSorley's in mid-century was a woman, and she wasn't allowed in. She owned the bar, and she would only go. She wanted to stay true to the bar and to her father, who had passed it along to her. So she just wouldn't go in except for Sundays after closing. And when they admitted women, her son wanted her to be the first woman to be served, and even then she refused.
Mm-hmm.
She just thought it wouldn't be right for her to go into a bar whose policy was to not let women in. So it's a pretty extraordinary story.
Well, there's a lot of extraordinary stories about that bar. I can't wait to go there. I mean, even during the time when I've forgotten what they used to call it when they couldn't sell alcohol anymore. They still were open because they had some kind of ale.
Yeah.
I don't know how they got through that, but I guess it never caused any trouble. And also, again, boy, John Lennon must have gone just about everywhere when he was in New York City. John Lennon, as you note here, had the best quote of anybody. He said, "McSorley's is a place of history, mystery, and mysticism," and that summed it up for you as well. Ah, that there's a great deal of mystery about all of these kind of things. What is your favorite place in this? This is a stupid question, but I can't help but ask it because I'm pretty stupid. And that is, what is your favorite of all the 75 places within this book?
It's hard to pick one single favorite. I have favorites in categories I'm partial to Papaya King because I just love those hot dogs. And I'm also very fond of Keene's Steakhouse, which we didn't talk about because it's a very New York-y place, and it was one of the first I wrote about. I feel like it really captures the city. I guess my favorite discovery that I didn't know about before I worked on this was the one I told you about, Markey's,
because
it's just it's like going into someone's house for dinner.
Well, what I learned about the 21 Club, I'm so glad you did that one. I had no idea. I felt like everybody, 21 Club, I guess you got to be a member. But you don't have to be a member, right?
No. A lot of people go in wondering how to join, and really anyone is admitted if you want to spend, I think it's like $35 for a hamburger. But if you want to do that, then you're admitted.
Hey, but that's a little bit cheaper than some of those other hamburgers at about $1,000 or whatever.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, what are the places? Boy, all too short, Mitch. I am so sorry, but hopefully one of these days we are going to get together and go to a couple of these places. I've learned a great deal from just work. Friends, the book is called Discovering Vintage New York, A Guide to the City's Timeless Shops, Bars, Delis, and More. Globe Picot, and of course, go to his blog, Mitch's blog, mbvintagenewyork.blogspot.com. And I'll tell you what, get a copy of this book, and you can prove that you bought it. You can have any book that I've ever written, absolutely free. Thank you for joining us, Mitch.
Thank you, Dr. Bob.
Stimulating talk around the clock. And breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Jane Metz.